A healthy life starts with great sleep. Wake refreshed with Avocado's GOTS-certified organic green mattress, delivering breathable, back-loving support, natural materials from Avocado's own sustainable wool and latex farms, easy financing, a one-year sleep trial, and deep, restorative slumbers. Organic sleep awaits at avocadomattress.com.
When you're here, but you're still far, I love you wherever you are. I believe it's time for truly, darkly, creepily. And there we have our intro.
And there's our intro.
And there it is.
That's how it's done, people.
Hey. Hi, Quinlan.
Where, what city are you in? What city are you calling from?
That's a great call. I'm calling from Bristol, and so much to update you on. Well, or not. We did a show here in Bristol, and it went so well. We had so much fun. It was well attended, and the audience just like was so on board, so game. They were so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So we had gotten off of the show. In fact, spoiler alert, we went over 20 minutes. That's how much fun we were having. We like kept improvising, kept laughing, kept having a good fucking time.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people's meet cutes that they sent in was, I married my first cousin.
Whoa. Still married?
Still married.
Brave.
It was wild. Really brave to share. Really, 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 really brave. Okay, great. So that was the high. The low was I'm in charge of accommodations, of apartments, of where we're staying, nights of shows. And while I was on the way to Bristol, I was like, I had booked this place. I had the website. I booked it. I paid for it. And then I looked through my emails, and I don't think I pressed the confirm booking button, and it didn't save. And so on the way to the theater, I was like, I have to find another place. I booked one place and they were like, we actually can't host you same day because it's not ready. Sorry, you have to cancel. So then I had to find another place. The reviews seemed decent. It was affordable. I was like, whatever, fuck it, let's go. So by the time we finish the show at 11:30 at night, or I'm sorry, 10:30 at night, we have to go to the place that we're staying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually like such a fun scavenger hunt to like find the lockbox. How do you get into the house? Turn the lights, you know, all that stuff. So I get in the house, and the only thing I'm going to do right now is show you, I'm going to send you some pictures. And I'd like you to tell me what you're seeing.
Oh my God. Carrie. What? Wait.
Can you explain to the dear listeners, dear readers?
It's like a wall that is covered in dust and dirt and water mold and peeling wallpaper. Oh my God. And Carrie just moved the mirror on the wall, and behind it is just like pure rust. Like the mirror has never been moved. There's no paint behind the mirror on the wall. And the bed is just like a bed with a comforter on it and nothing else in a room, like pushed against a closet door so the closet can't open. It's alarming. It is an alarming space. Like, it looks like a crazy crack den. This is so scary.
If you look at the mirror, which luckily I didn't move until later, but if you look at it, that's all mold.
Yeah.
That's three-dimensional mold. It is crazy. So we immediately contact them, and they're like, this is not safe. And they're like, we just had a long-term tenant move, and the cleaners didn't say anything. And we're like, this is not something that happens overnight. Like, and also the mirror.
No, it's not like it got left a mess. It's a disaster. Like, it's not.
It is. And they were like, do you think you can leave it with us? And here's what's so fucking crazy. We got it on booking.com. This is not sponsored, but then we had to pay through a separate link to them. So we're like, are we going to get our fucking money back? So fingers probably crossed. Not. Anyway, so I moved.
We stayed
the night there.
You did? Oh, because it's like
I had to. It was 11 o'clock at night.
That's really scary. Are you going
to I didn't stay. Nobody stayed in that room. Nobody stayed in that room. But mm-hmm. then you stayed in the other rooms and there was mold in every other fucking room. It is. I've never. And then they didn't have like the Wi-Fi wasn't working. And then, I mean, not that I was going to take a shower or do anything in that space. They had no hot water.
This is crazy.
It was wild. So like,
this is a scam.
I'm going to burn something down if I don't get my money back. But that felt like a low. But like, that's the thing. It's on tour. It's like you have these highs of like, we're making people laugh. We're having a good time. We're having so much fun. And then you have the lows of like, wow, I think I'm going to die from mold exposure.
Oh, terrifying. Honestly, terrifying.
That was just my last 24 hours and I'm still reeling. And like, it was rough.
I'm glad you're alive.
It was rough. Hey, I'm alive now. Who knows if I'm going to be alive later?
Do you want to welcome everyone to Truly...
Darkly, creepily. That's Quinlan Posner,
and I'm Carrie Ipama. And we want to thank Megan P. Do you know what you do to me? You make me see all the ways that I love you, Megan P. Coming through like P. comes quickly and softly and easily. So
I hope your pee is natural.
It looks like you're really hydrated.
I hope it's clear to see, Megan P, that you mean so much to me. And Quinn, we have so much fun seeing you. We don't see you because we just see your name. Megan P.
How about we thank Michelle R.
Michelle R. That feels like the same one, and I want to make a different one. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Michelle. Michelle, my bell. My bell. Michelle. You are like a shell that I found in the sea. So beautiful to me, listening to the ocean, such a commotion. You are amazing, Michelle R. Where are you? I can't wait to have lunch.
Thanks a bunch, Megan R. You are so swell. You ain't going to hell because you support two comedians. And I don't know what rhymes with comedians, but let's just say adios.
Nice. Really Thanks. Solid work today.
Thank you.
Let's also thank Paige B.
Paige B. Nope, I don't want to do that. That's the same. Like I gotta keep phoning it in. Like, it's really hard to get out of it. Hold on. Paige B. You are. Is it Paige B?
Like the name Paige, and then yeah, the no, I last know. Initial
but
is
I
B?
Feel like the problem is with a lot of letters is it rhymes with E, and so it's always like Paige B. You mean so much to me.
Oh,
and
yeah,
frankly,
and
like,
it's like we really well. You know what? Take out the B. Just we yeah. want to thank. We want to thank Paige. You took away our rage. You locked us in a cage of love. It's a Patreon cage of love, and we're inside it with you, Paige.
Paige, that was fun. That was Quinn doing meatloaf, and I loved it. I think, mm-hmm. You know.
Like a bat out of Paige.
Like a bat out of the cage. Like a bat out of the page cage. You know, R.I.P. Rest in power, meat loaf.
I think
wow,
it's time
Quinn.
To tell stories.
That's, already?
I gotta be honest. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I'm kind of like, let's cop in.
Okay. Oh. By the way, should we just say, hey, if you're paying us money, we're going to give you a little word right now. Here, go. Okay, cool. Okay, great. Now that you're done, let's get to the real juice of the app. Quinn,
yeah,
tell a story.
Get to the meat of it. I'm going to tell you the story of Alyssa Cherney. This is information I got from Wikipedia, People, NBC, ABC, Fox, MelMagazine.com by James McMahon. Alyssa Cherney lived in Phoenix, Arizona. And when she's three, her mom, who is a single mom, gets remarried to Michael Cherney. So Michael, it's like a Brady Bunch situation where she has a sister and Michael has three kids and they all move in together. He adopts Alyssa and her older brother.
It's not a Brady Bunch. It's a Donny Osmond. Okay, no, sorry.
It becomes a Brady Bunch.
Okay.
Because it's three and three, but it's Sarah. Sarah Alyssa's younger sister is biologically her mom's and Michael.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Does that make
sense?
So
she's got a step. She's got, they've got half siblings. They got step siblings. They've got
every
all
kind
of the siblings.
Of sibling okay. in the house.
I wouldn't say it's a Brady Bunch as much as a Kardashian.
Okay. I'll have to take your word for it. As you know, I do not tune in, even though I respect
you don't keep
those
up.
That do. I'm not keeping up with them. No. I have to say that this is where the story gets quite sad because Alyssa's mom dies when she's 9. So mm-hmm. now this dad has the two kids he adopted that were his widowed wife or his whatever, his dead wife. He has her two kids, his 3 biological kids. Oh, his 4 biological kids. It's a lot, right?
There's a lot of kids.
He gets pretty depressed and crazy. I remember Sarah later said, when my mom died, it totally broke him. We didn't recognize him. He was like a changed person. He already had depression beforehand. And then afterwards, all these things happened where he lost his job as an electrician. He had this terrible knee injury that happened that made him really, really angry and really sad. It's not a great life, from what I understand it, for Alyssa very specifically. It kind of sounds like he treated her and Sarah like night and day. Sarah's his biological daughter, the younger, yeah. and she could kind of do whatever she wanted. And he, I don't know, turned a blind eye to anything that was behavioral.
Is that like a youngest or oldest thing? Or do you think that was a favoritism because it was his daughter?
I think it's the second, maybe. But we'll
Some might say that's the latter. Yeah.
We'll unpack it a little more, but Alyssa, she doesn't have a lot of freedoms. She does have a job. She works at Jack in the Box. She does have a boyfriend. James, her older brother, will say that she had a very tense relationship with her father, Michael. He was very, very strict with her, very
Wait,
controlling.
Her stepfather.
Her stepfather.
Okay,
her
thank
stepfather,
you.
Michael. So now the person that, yeah, she's living under his roof, his rules, and his rules for her are not the same as his rules for everyone, and his rules for her are very, very strict. She complains about it a lot. She talks about wanting to run away. She talks about wanting to go to California. And in the year 2000, she writes down an essay. I don't understand what a driver's ed essay is, but I read she wrote a driver's ed essay where she calculated how long and how far it would take to drive to California. So she's thinking about it a lot, is I think the point. And in 2001, her father records a phone call of her. Michael records a phone call, her stepdad, of her talking to her boyfriend. And she's like, would your parents let you go to California with me? You can tell she's got plans brewing.
She's itching to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Michael says at this time that he knew that Alyssa was ready to leave. He knew she wanted to be gone for about a year. And he said she wanted to go live somewhere else. I didn't think she was ready. I didn't want her to. I wanted her to stay. Now, he has surveillance cameras all over the house, and they're pretty much there to monitor Alyssa, not anyone else. In fact, at one point, he proves to Sarah that he's not watching her to make her feel more comfortable, but he is watching Alyssa, and he's very, like, open about that. He's like, we have to keep an eye on her. Like, she's a problem child. He would follow her to Jack in the Box sometimes where she worked and sit in his car while she was at work and watch her at work. And he's captured all kinds of things. He's, you know, are you leaving the house when I don't want you to leave the house? What time are you getting home? Did you make out with your boyfriend? He has these things on camera, and he's recording her phone calls. As I said, that's why we know she had a conversation with her boyfriend about wanting to potentially leave town.
This is weird.
This is very weird.
And has
right?
she done anything at this point
Not that
to,
we're
to
aware
warrant
of.
This type of
I think
of
it was
behavior?
Normal 17. She's 17 years old. I think it was stuff like, you know, maybe he found out she smoked a cigarette. Maybe she made out with her boyfriend. It was just normal 17-year-old stuff from what I know. And I think that he was really blowing it out of proportion. So then the last day of her junior year, her boyfriend is talking to her, John, and she says, Michael, my stepdad, is picking me up to take me out to lunch. He's taking me out to lunch from school. She does not return from this lunch that she goes to with her dad. She does not ever return. Michael says what happened at that lunch is that they had a fight because Alyssa wanted to stay out later with friends that night, and he was saying no. And he was kind of doing the, like, when you're under my roof, you have to, like, do what I say. And he said, you make daddy a nervous wreck. He says they had this huge fight. And then he didn't see her after that lunch either. That is also Sarah's last day of school of seventh grade. And she went to a water park with friends. And her dad is late picking her up from it. Okay, so they go back to the house. They find a note in Alyssa's bedroom that says she's run away to California. Sarah, the seventh grader, is devastated, the little sister, by this note. Not just because her sister went to California, but because in the note, she says in the note, Sarah, you wanted me gone. Now you have it. And so she feels blamed. She feels devastated.
No.
The note says that Alyssa took $300 from her dad and that she's run away. It looks like her handwriting. It's like, you know, she had some signature goofy things she did in her handwriting. It totally looks like her handwriting. And Michael says when he sees this note, his heart stops and he starts calling around trying to find her. He calls the police and he's like, my daughter's run away. Some of the strange things about the runaway is that her room is a mess, which they just say was uncharacteristic. But maybe if you're running away, you don't care about that. But she has her backpack on the floor and just everything spread out. It just doesn't. It's like, what did you pack? You know, it doesn't look.
And what did you take with you if your backpack's not with you?
Not her phone. Not only did she not take her phone, but even though she took $300, she had a bank account with money in it. Not a bunch of money, but it never gets touched.
But money. She's dead. Someone killed her.
Someone killed her. The other confusing part about this is she's a teenager and she was supposed to go to a party that night. Remember, she was arguing about wanting to stay later at the party.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's like she doesn't tell her friends she's not going to go to the party. She's doesn't go to the party.
She doesn't tell anyone.
It just rubs me wrong about a 17-year-old. And just to leave alone doesn't make a ton of sense. But you're like, I guess she just felt so controlled. Maybe she ran away. But the note doesn't talk about the fight with the dad, which it feels like if you just had a fight with your dad and you're going to be a little bit vindictive toward your little sister in the note, why the fuck isn't she being vindictive toward him? Like, it just doesn't reference. Yeah. It doesn't feel, even though it looks like she wrote this note, it doesn't have indication markers of the things that we know were happening at that time.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Like, it almost could be like a note she wrote previously.
It could be a note that she wrote and her dad found it that morning and then they fought about it at lunch. I don't know. It just feels off. It feels real off. And, you know, Michael's running around putting up posters and by all accounts trying to find her, trying to find his daughter.
I guess his camera can't reach to California. I guess his surveillance footage.
Well, I'll tell you what happens. A week after
he loses all of it around the house. They try to look for it and it's gone.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Well, Color me shocked.
So basically what happens is that a week after she's been gone, Michael gets a phone call in the morning and he hears her voice. And he says that the conversation's kind of scrambled and weird. And she says, is it you? And she's cursing at him and then says, leave me alone, and then hangs up. Now, he records all his calls, right? But somehow this one doesn't get recorded.
For some reason.
But they are able to see it happened, that there was a call. They trace it to a payphone in Riverside, California, which fits the story that she ran away to California. So Michael then goes there and hangs flyers with her picture, but nobody contacts him. He contacts the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He registers her as missing there. The police are like, look, we can't really help you out with this. This is a runaway. There's not going to be an investigation.
Right.
Because they're just treating it like, sorry, your kid ran away.
Like a runaway.
But because they're not treating it as an investigation, they don't interview family. They don't interview friends. They don't do an Amber Alert. And they don't, the one thing they don't question that I'm still freaked out about is like, this girl has money in her bank account. She's not using it. Like,
also, $300 doesn't get you anywhere. Like, she takes $300 and that's supposed to set her up for life. And we never hear from this young woman again.
That's right. And who did she know in California? It doesn't make any sense. So Sarah's like, she's going to come back. Sarah's really sad. She's sleeping in her bed and wearing her clothes and like misses her sister. In 2006, Tymus Hymera is a guy that is serving a life sentence in Florida because he murdered someone. He has told everyone he's a serial killer and been like, I killed actually like up like 20 or more people. I'm totally a serial killer.
Real piece of work. Yeah, real piece
of shit. Goes to one of the guards and hands him a picture that he tore out of a magazine of Alyssa. And he's like, I killed her. I'm going to make you famous. And the guard's like, okay, I'll bring the police to talk to you. And they're like, excuse me, Mr. Hymer, what's the story? And he's like, well, I strangled her to death in a hotel. And then I dismembered her in a tub. And then I just like ditched her body at a recycling center. And they're like, whoa, dark, so I guess we're not going to find her. And he's like, yeah, but you know, she was a heroin addict. And they're like, definitely not. And he's like, oh, really? Oh, you know what? That could have been somebody else that I did that to. Maybe it wasn't her. And they're like, this is a very awkward conversation at this point. But because this happens, it's important it happens because it's been years. And when it happens, her story hits the news cycle again.
Yeah.
When it hits the news cycle, it's been 5 years, 6 years. So the kids that knew her, when nobody really came to talk to them because they were like, oh, Alyssa ran away. Now it feels different.
Now
it
they're
feels
going, like maybe no, something it was happened suspicious. To her.
Well, but not only that, but now they're not 16. They're not 17. They're not 18. They're in their 20s and they're 20s, mature yeah. enough that they have they're less scared maybe to come forward with what they know or think. So they start to come to the police and tell stories about the stepdad saying, we knew from her perspective that he was obsessed with her and that he was tracking her all the time. She told some of us that he molested her. Her boyfriend's like, yeah, she told me that her dad took her out to the desert and sexually assaulted her. And there's a school teacher that's like, yeah, I heard something to that effect. And another friend is like, yeah, Alyssa told us that she woke up one night and was gagged and bound and tied to a chair with him on top of her.
Oh, my God.
And they're like, sir, we would love to do a polygraph. And he's like, no. And they're like, just an interview? And he's like, nah. And they're like, but don't you want to find Alyssa? What about, it sounds like you have video, you were like taping all these calls. And he's like, yeah, but I don't have the one where she called. It just wasn't on that day. And they're like, yeah, yeah. Okay, about that. It sounds like you were videotaping her all the time. Could we look at the video from the day that she went missing? And he's like, it doesn't exist on that day. For just some reason, it
weird,
does not.
Weird. What a coinkidink.
They start talking to people. They talk to her nephew who had lived with them for a while. Not her nephew. I think Michael Turney's nephew. I don't know. I can't mathematically in my head figure out what the relation to her
that's
would
okay.
be.
That's okay. A relative.
A relative had lived with them, a young man. He found a VHS cassette that was labeled Dr. Doolittle. He put it in the VCR, and it was a video of a woman lying on a sofa in just shorts, topless, with a newspaper over her face, and he thinks it was Alyssa. And in another frame, there was another woman in the room, also covered with newspaper. And in these videos, Michael Turney is just sitting there watching them. Like, it's very, very scary footage that is, I cannot imagine. It sounds like a horror film to stumble upon this and see this man, like, just, like, doing these creepy things. So the kid just moves out. He's like, what the fuck? I'm out of here. So with all these people coming forward and all this missing footage and la, 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 in 2008, the detectives call Sarah and they're like, what do you think? We think that your dad might have done something to Alyssa. And she's like, no way. No way. Like, she cannot believe it. But remember, the way he parented her was like the idea that they're like
totally different,
sexually assaulted your sister. But things start coming back to her, like the fact that she had smoked cigarettes the day her dad picked her up at the water park. And that he didn't say anything. Like, he was distracted. It's the idea she's like. Yeah.
He was so overprotective. So distracted. But like, why was he so just. Yeah. Yeah.
That day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So then they're going to raid the house because they're like, he's got to be hiding something. So they get whatever permits they need. And they raid his home. And the Phoenix Police Bomb Squad and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives sees what they say is the biggest seizure of improvised explosive devices they've ever done. 28 pipe bombs. They've got all this kind of weaponry. They've got 19 like high assault rifles,
Quinn,
handguns.
This is
silencers,
not where I thought you were going.
A van filled with gasoline, like just really crazy stuff that they, yeah, they're not expecting to find that either. So when they find that, they're like,
oh my God,
what? So then they go arrest Michael while he's getting his mail. And while they arrest him, he's just carrying on him a knife, 2 loaded guns, and 7 magazines of ammo.
So 7 like, magazines of ammo? What the fuck is wrong with you?
They find an almost 100-page manifesto called Diary of a Madman Martyr. And he has all these copies of it. They all are addressed to different media outlets. And the sum of it is that he's a disgruntled worker because of the electric place he worked that he got fired from. And he's like, it was hazardous work conditions. I was a whistleblower. So they hated me. So I got fired. Everything that happened to me was unfair. And I think that they're the ones that kidnapped and murdered my daughter. They kidnapped and murdered Alyssa. And I'm going to get back at them. And I know that she's buried in Desert Center, California. And in fact, I know that because I killed the 2 assassins who did it. And my plan is
this is his alibi? This is his cover up for murdering his daughter?
Yes. oh my God. His plan is to drive the van that has all the gas with all these explosives into Union Hall and blow it up and then shoot anybody that survives and then kill himself. And that is his plan. And when they find all this, they stop his plan. They put him, I mean, he has to go to trial.
No, they stop his plan? Are you kidding? I thought they'd go, let's see how this plays out.
Let's see how this goes. Yeah. Let's watch him a little bit. Let's lay back. God. Let's lay low. Well, in speaking about all this, we lose sight of what they were really there looking for, which was stuff that would pertain to.
Was child pornography. Was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. One thing they do find is they find contracts that he made her sign prior to her disappearance, and one is a contract that promises that he never molested her, which seems like a really weird thing to make your kid sign. The other thing he's made her sign is just a contract about what she will and won't do, like this is what you're not allowed to do till you're 18, and it has lots of kind of explicit sexual stuff in it of like what he doesn't want her to do till she's 18.
Oh my God.
But it's just like
Oh my God, dude.
Like, what?
Did he kill her mother?
Oh my God, no. Her mother had, I think, cancer. Her mother did not. It was not a mysterious death. Sarah
all of it's
visits
mysterious
her dad
around
while
this guy
he's
at
in
this
prison.
Point.
So he has to go to prison, obviously, for all these, for fucking planning to murder everybody.
Yeah.
Sarah visits and she says, did you do it? Did you kill Alyssa? And he says really weird things like, if you want to know the answer to that, come visit me on my deathbed. And then when he gets out of prison for
I'm
going to
take that as a yes. Hey, daddy, that's a yes. That's a yes.
He says to her that he'll confess everything if the state agrees to give him lethal injection within 10 days. So, it's such a yes, right? So he ends up getting arrested and charged with her murder in 2020.
So, oh,
like 20
my
years
God.
After she went missing. 20 years after she went missing.
That poor and young woman.
They
that
just
poor
finally,
Alyssa.
He's arrested and charged, but they just did the trial. Like the verdict came in July of 2023, just last year.
It's because they probably were collecting all of these fucking.
He was acquitted.
You're lying.
He was acquitted.
You're lying because they don't have a body. Because they don't
have a
body.
This is what they said. There's not been a shred of physical evidence in this case. No body, no crime scene, no evidence to suggest that a murder even took place. That's what his attorney says. And they say the court has considered the... And then the court said that they've considered the evidence and find that substantial evidence does not exist to warrant a conviction. All 5 of the kids, all 5 of the Brady Bunch kids in this instance...
Believe
that he did it.
Yeah.
And the most vocal about it has been Sarah and James. So Sarah and one of her brothers, James, they have a podcast, actually, Voices for Justice. and they've talked a lot about it. And they were so gracious about this verdict. They were like, we're glad she had her day in court. We respect the court's decision. It was not the decision mm-hmm. that we wanted. Mm-hmm. But they've just been really vocal about, like, thank you to the police for all your support. Thank you so much to true crime fans, actually, for, like, making this case known, because they don't feel like they got justice. They say they want to thank the true crime community. They say, you became Alyssa's army and surrounded us both with love, and we will never forget that. And then Sarah said of her sister Alyssa, you moved mountains to protect me from the reality of our lives so I could have the best childhood possible. That is something I can never repay you for. I just hope you know that I tried and that you deserved so much better. And that's disappointing story of Alyssa Turney, because truly, I don't, you know, legality probably demands that I not say this, but it's like, that dude did it. Like, what?
Oh.
Isn't that
they're
so
recording
crazy?
Her, the obsession with her, the like.
And the fact that she told all her friends he's molesting me.
She told all of her friends.
And he's like, sign this to say that I'm not. What? And then they all say, like, I think she did write that letter and that he found it. And he was like, she's going to steal from me and run away. And if she does, the secret is no longer under my roof and under my control that I did this to her.
I bet he made her write it. I bet he made her write it before he killed her.
It's a million ways it could have gone, but I just know that it seems to me that there's a lot of evidence in support of the fact that he molested her and that he didn't want people finding out about it. He's clearly a very unstable person. Look at this bomb situation, which is like, so what a bizarre side note to the whole damn thing. Unhinged. Whoa. And now a word from our sponsors.
Quinn, that story is so fucked up. Okay, well, I have like a little bit more of a positive story, but it's still a little dark and creepy. Well, it's pretty dark. Is it creepy? I'm going to let you, but it is a true story.
I'll be the one to decide.
I got this information from Wikipedia, Gale, Tuscaloosa News, Alabama News, and the New York Times, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Lurleen Wallace. I'm not going to talk about the fact that her name is Lurleen, except for right now. Her name is Lurleen. L-U-R-L-E-E-N.
Lurleen. Lurleen. Lurleen.
Lurleen. I'll guess. Yeah, what state do you think she's from?
Indiana.
No.
Texas.
No, close.
Louisiana? Kentucky.
It's Alabama. You had three guesses. It was Alabama. All
right.
You failed. I'm not going to tell the story in a minute. No, let's go back in time.
Goodbye.
Bye. That's how the podcast ends. Lurleen, she is born in 1926, so that we know kind of like gauge time of her life, you know? And she meets her husband, George Wallace, when she's a teenager. She's working at like the Five and Dime, something or other. He's a little bit older than her. It's 1943. She's 16 years old. And the two of them get married. He is 22 years old. Yikes. She has four kids and she manages the home while her husband works in politics. Now, to be clear, this is like the 1940s, 1950s. Democrats and Republicans are not the same, right? So they're Southern Democrats. So they believe in segregation at this point in time in the 1950s. And she's holding down the fort. She's raising the kids while he's off on his political career. And amongst his political career, he's neglecting his family. He's having affairs. He's fucking around. And it's the late 1950s. And you know what she does? Lurleen says, fuck you, guy. I'm going to file for divorce. Now, a divorce is not good for a political career. So what does he do? He apologizes. He comes back home. I'm sorry. I'm going to be a faithful father. I'm going to be a good husband. A faithful father, a good husband. I'm be a good father. I'm be a faithful husband. Whatever. Whatever it is, they're empty promises because, spoiler alert, he's neither one of those things. So she has her fourth child in 1961. And in 1963, a couple years later, George becomes the governor of fucking Alabama. He's really into segregation. Like I said, people really rally behind him. It's the racist South. It's not good. So at this point, she's the first lady of Alabama. Now, she is seemingly a decent first lady, where she opens the first floor of the governor mansion 7 days a week. She does not serve alcohol at official functions. So I feel like she's probably a little bit like, she's very conservative. And what's interesting in Alabama is that it's one of the states, because a lot of southern states did this, which is the Constitution forbids consecutive terms. It forbids back-to-back terms by governors at this point in time.
I don't mind it.
So he can only serve 4 years at a time, and then he has to take another four-year break, essentially. And it's very common. And I just found out recently that as of 2024, Virginia still has this law in their constitution that as a governor, you can't serve consecutive terms.
Huh. It doesn't bother me. Does it bother you?
Just interesting, I thought. No, it doesn't bother me, but I think what happens is he tries to get creative. He does first try to get them to overturn this, to change the Constitution so that he could run again, because he's picking up steam and he's pretty popular at the time. And it's 1965. If you remember correctly, he started in 1963, so he's got, you know, until 1967, right? To change this sort of ruling. So 1965, he tries to change it. That fails. So to combat the restrictions of this office of holding two consecutive terms, he's like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put my wife up for the election. I'm going to let her run. And then basically I'm going to control everything from the back. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So he puts his wife on his ballot. That sounds sexual. So this was done before. There is some precedent to say that this has been done before. In 1924, the governor of Texas had his wife, Miriam Wallace Ferguson, she was elected while her husband, James E. Ferguson, ran from the back. So Lurleen, if you can see her at this moment, she's really not one for office. She's pretty shy. She doesn't really have any interest in working in politics. She's actually called the most unlikely candidate imaginable, but she goes on to defeat 9 opponents. And to be clear, at this point in time, because Republicans were in the minority, as long as you won the primary, you essentially were in. So she defeats 9 Southern Democrats. And what's interesting is on the ballot, she goes by Mrs. George C. Wallace instead of her name, Lurleen. And frankly, I wish she went by Lurleen, because it's a crazy name. And she even said when she was running, she was like, my husband's going to be my number one assistant. And so she gets elected into office. The most independent action of her term, just to put into perspective for her, is she tried to get her husband to increase the appropriations, the money for Bryce Hospital. She was trying to give more money to an institution that helped the developmentally disabled. Mm-hmm. So in case we have any questions of why more women should be in power. Anyway, so spoiler alert, George Wallace does eventually go back in office, and he repeals the term limit, and he goes on to serve 3 more terms, 2 of which are consecutive. So we get to the end of this story and you go, okay, Carrie, this was not creepy. It's true. And maybe a little dark, right?
So boring if it's not true. If you're like, this is the
crazy story. Could you imagine? I was like, I actually lied about all of that.
And I'm like, that was bad.
But it all seems above board, right? Like she goes, she's like, okay, I'll run for office. That's totally fine. Well, let's flash back to 1961. This is really what I want to get into. Mm-hmm. 1961, she had her 4th child. Mm-hmm. She had her child by cesarean section. And her gynecologist at the time, the doctor, had noticed some tissue that looked suspicious. And so the doctor was able to take some of the tissue and biopsy it. And it came back as cancerous. Now, here's the fucking creepy shit, is that when the doctor got this cancer diagnosis, he did what was customary at the time, which was tell her husband. Her husband decided not to tell her.
Ooh.
She had uterine cancer in 1961, and he never told her. Now, keep in mind, he also told everyone, he was like, to make it clear, no one should tell Lurleen about her body. And that also meant not only did she not know that she had cancer, but also he prevented her from getting any follow-up care, any sort of intervention from an early stage that could have possibly helped her. All the while, he knows she has cancer. He is now putting her up to campaign, to work, to be the name on the ballot so that he can run everything from behind the scenes. What's really also what's also fucked up is that this happened in 1961. In 1962, he even discussed her cancer with his staffers. And she had no idea.
Oh my God.
No fucking clue.
And they wouldn't think to tell her. You gotta know.
Well, he was like, hey, pinky promise. Hey, everybody pinky promise me. And you know what? I guarantee you this is all edit. This is all conjecture and I'm editorializing. But like, you bet your ass. He's like, I could get her to run. That's fine. And she's going to be really weak. So I'm sure it will be even more effective for me. Ugh. You know what I mean? Like this, I don't like the guy. So it's 1965. It's 4 years after her last child is born. Her fourth child is born. 4 years after her husband finds out that she has cancer. And she's experiencing some abnormal bleeding. And when she goes into the doctor, she finally finds out that she has uterine cancer. At the same time, she finds out that her husband knew all along. And at this point, you know, she's fucking pissed. She finds out that not only that staffers for his campaign knew before she knew what was going on in her body. Yet again, it's 1965. She agrees to be the name on the ballot so that he could continue his tenure as politics. I think at this point, she's both mother and father to her kids. She just wants to take care of her kids. If this is going to get this guy off her fucking back, fine. Again, I'm editorializing, but fuck this guy. While she is a candidate, she is starting radiation therapy. She has a hysterectomy in 1966. After this, she's still getting cancer treatment, and she is hitting the campaign trail, giving speeches, fucking doing Herculean things, all while battling cancer. And she is elected. She is elected as the governor of Alabama. She is the first female governor of Alabama. And not only that, she is the third female governor nationally ever in history.
Sheesh.
And during her term, she is absolutely beloved. But unfortunately, because she has cancer and hasn't been doing much to mitigate it, her health begins to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. And she is in Alabama, and Alabama at the time does not have a cancer center. So she has to go back and forth from Texas to Alabama to Texas to Alabama. Mm-hmm. In 1967, she finds an abdominal growth, and by 1968, the cancer has spread. George Wallace, meanwhile, who's pulling the levers behind government, making it work, he lies to the press saying that she had won the fight against cancer. And the doctor's like, she's really weak, she's not doing well. But George Wallace kept campaigning the last couple weeks of her life. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, he's campaigning while she's in absolutely horrific pain, having to go between Alabama and Texas. She loses the battle to cancer May 7th, 1968, just 18 months into her term as governor, at her home, surrounded by her family. She is 41 years old, and at the time of her death, she weighs about 68 pounds. And this is important to note because during the last couple weeks of her life, she was very self-conscious about how she looked. She was a very modest woman, where she made it very clear. She says, "When I die, I know I am governor. But I don't want it to be a spectacle. I would like a closed casket, and I want it to be, you know, chill." I'm sure she didn't say the word chill, but
I'm sure she did.
I want it to be super chill.
I just want my funeral to be super chill.
I want to be chill. I just want to be chill.
And I want to be lowered into the ground to the song, "Drop It Like It's Hot."
Is that too much to ask?
Is that too much to ask?
So, like I said, she wanted to be... At her funeral, she lied in state in Alabama, and 21,000 mourners visited her body. And one wish that she was very explicit about was that she was self-conscious about how she looked, so she wanted a closed casket. So you know what her husband did?
Open casket.
He had an open casket because he was like, actually, she looked more like herself than I think she realized. And even though she's dead and she asked for a closed casket...
I do know
Open
better.
Her up.
I know better.
Open
and
her
I'm
up.
Alive.
Not even that. He put her under a glass case. I think reporters or someone at the time was like, it just was such a...
or something.
Yeah, such seriously. It was like she was a fishbowl. It was like everybody watching her.
Terrible.
She was succeeded by the Lieutenant Governor, Albert Brewer. And within days of passing, there was an organization formed to help make a center, a cancer center or cancer hospital in Alabama a reality. Just because if we didn't hate George Wallace enough, after her death, George Wallace has to move out of the governor's mansion and he moves back to a home that they bought. And keep in mind, he has four kids with this woman. He has four kids with Lurleen. One's 23, she's married, she's out of the house. Another's 18, 16, and six is the youngest, right? Mm-hmm. And so do they move with their father? No.
No.
No. They don't. The young ones are sent to live with family members and friends. George goes on to marry two more times, and wouldn't you believe it? It must be a shocker to know that both of them end in divorce. It is a real fucked up story, and I would say it is creepy to have your medical history or medical diagnosis shared with your husband, and they can opt to share it with you or not. But just a little addendum, because Lurleen, we should give her credit where credit is due. She is Alabama's, like I said, first female governor. Well, she holds that office as the only woman until 2017, and then the next little lady comes in, and her name is Kay Ivey. And she, interestingly enough, is succeeded into that position. She's not even duly elected the first time another woman gets back on the fucking governor's mansion. Kay Ivey only got into the governor's office because her predecessor, Robert J. Bentley, resigned because of a sex scandal with his political aide, which is very, I don't know, it makes sense to me that women will come into power when men fuck up or men have to, you know, I don't know, be the shadow candidate.
yeah.
Exactly. It's just very kind dark, of fun, dark. Isn't
for
it?
For sure true.
What is interesting is... for sure creepy. Is it creepy? I think it's creepy. So Kay Ivey, just so you know, Kay Ivey, what's interesting is that she worked for the 1966 governor's race that elected Lurleen. So Kay Ivey, who is a future Alabama governor, like, actually worked on the campaign. Yeah. Fingers crossed, I find a husband who is desperate for power. And to be clear, Kay Ivey did end up winning a full term on her own terms, on her own, in 2018, and she is still serving today. And as of 2024, she is the current oldest serving governor at 79 years old. I probably disagree with her politically on every step of the way, but you know what? We still like to see women in power. Anyway, so that's the story of Lurleen and her cancer diagnosis that she was not privy to.
Very scary.
Scary stuff. You know, it's interesting. I think withholding information is a delicate balance, right? Like, if someone's dying, do you tell them? Like, there's so many stories of people that you've heard that are, like, dying of cancer, and they're like, we're just not going to tell them.
People that find out they have cancer and then die really quickly afterward, almost like you get the feeling that if they didn't know, they'd have lived longer.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally, totally, totally.
Yeah. But I think the point is, like, a lot of it's like, what's the intention? And obviously this guy's intention was all self-preservation. So,
yeah.
He sucks.
Yeah. Not a good guy. But don't worry, he served more terms after her death, in case you forgot. He went on to serve three more terms very popular after her death. But, yeah, here we are. Anyway, I had to tell you that story of Lurleen. Also, what a great name, Lurleen. And also, okay.
And also, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Mm. Join Patreon. Why does your computer keep falling and, like, pointing
because
at the ceiling?
Because I am doing this.
It's making you look
I am drunk. Doing this. I am doing this on a bed because I don't have a desk.
I see that. What's your new place like? Can't beat that old one. Show me.
You know what? I'll show you.
Okay, regular.
Do I look like I'm at an asylum?
Yeah, why do Airbnbs look like that? You got to stay at cuter places, Carrie. Live a little.
The cuter places cost more money. Quinn, we are not making money. We got to keep it tight.
Keep it tight. Keep it tight. Keep it classy. Start sharing a bed.
Keep it cheap. Keep
couple
it tight.
A couple weeks, we're going to be podcasting, and KK is just going to be sitting right next to you.
KK and I shared a bed the last couple nights because we stayed at our publicist's house. And you know what? I was like, it's free. We're staying together. And she was like, I'm on the same page. So
nice. Well, enjoy.
You know, the life of an actor is super classy.
Tell me about the life of an actor, because from where I'm sitting, it's very sweaty and broke.
You know what, Quinn? That's not wrong. But you know what? I'm having fun.
Good.
Yeah, I'm having fun.
I told you that Ko was like, he said, sometimes I think I'm a girl, but then I realize I'm not a girl. And I said, how do you know you're not a girl? And he goes, because I love school and learning. Did I tell you this? He goes, I love school, learning. Like, I get really interested in things. And I just looked at him, like, really confused. And he goes, and girls just want to have fun. Isn't that funny? I was like, that's pretty good, Ko. That's pretty good.
Girls, wait, just who told him that?
I don't know.
He didn't make that up. He didn't make that up.
But where did he even hear that song? I'm not like playing that song. I should.
Where did he hear that from? Where the fuck did he hear that from?
I was dying laughing.
That's the funniest thing I've ever heard. He, like, what I love about it is that he was riling you up so fucking hard.
Yeah, he was winding me up. Because he knew it.
You had to be like, I have to tell him that girls are smart.
And then he
absolutely fucking incredible. We got to tour that kid. Me and you are going to be his groupie. We're going to bring him out. He's going to be, I love the idea of Koa being a shock jock. Like what is it? A shock jock? What is it called? A shock?
I don't know, radio, but I love the idea of literally anyone in this house getting a job is an idea I love. So,
right, do the bills feel like they're crashing? Okay, goodbye.
Nope. Goodbye.